I'm Natalie Kestacher, and this is the Pocket Docs podcast. As writer and journalist Susan Mousehart says, history can whisper its secrets to us in the most unexpected places. When Susan went furniture shopping, she didn't expect that it would lead her to unravelling a shameful chapter in Australian history. Here's Susan Mousehart's Pine and Prejudice.
When you go shopping for secondhand furniture online, you're looking for a bargain, not a mystery. But a couple of weeks ago, when I brought this dressing table home, I got both. Solving the mystery led me to secret places. Places in the history of this state and this country. But also places that history books never go. Deep into the bottom drawers of fear and bigotry and love and longing. And how it all impacted on one family's life.
I'd say the impact would have been, it's just whole life changing.
It's funny, you know, as a journalist, you think you know where to look for a story. But sometimes the most amazing stories are right there in the room with you, just part of the furniture. So, yeah, I was looking online for a cheap but sort of Federation-y chest of drawers for the guest room. It wasn't hard. The first piece I saw was the one I ended up buying.
Hello?
In the setting, it looked a little incongruous.
Hi.
A low-ceiling bedroom in a modern duplex. I felt awkward opening the drawers to do a closer inspection. They were still filled with the owner's socks and underwear. But the hardware was original and intact. The dovetail joins were sound and the runners smooth. I asked about the history of the piece, and the guy, who was really nice, just shrugged. No idea, he said. It's been in the family for ages. We settled on a price. It was crazy cheap, yet I'm ashamed to say I asked for a cash discount.
Thanks.
And got it. And my son and I set about wrestling it into his car, which was when I noticed the writing on the back.
I saw that there were this thing was burned into it. There was words on the back of it. So, got closer and saw the words Asiatic labor. But I just thought, oh my, Asiatic, what? Like, what is that?
Days after I brought the piece home, those words, Asiatic labor, they kept ringing in my ears Asiatic like a gong. I asked friends and family if they'd ever seen such a thing.
I don't have my glasses.
No one
had. Asiatic labor. So what's that?
When I Googled it, and of course I Googled it, I found a confusing trail of news clippings from the turn of the century. All of them seem to reference the Chinese furniture industry right here in Australia. Hang on, the Chinese furniture industry in Australia? Was that even a thing? The answer, I figured, was probably right around the corner. You see, I live in a really old neighborhood, by Perth standards anyway, and it's a bit of a hub for antique dealers. So I snapped a few pictures on my smartphone and walked around the block.
My name is Paul Bowler. I run Matilda's Antiques in North Fremantle, Western Australia. I'm very well versed in the art of antique furniture design manufacturing throughout the 18th, 19th and early 20th centuries.
Can I ask you a few questions?
Of course you can.
Okay, great. Because I have a specific... I'm on a particular mission.
Right. Okay. It's an Arts and Crafts Australian Kauri Pine Duchess dressing table made approximately 1905 to 1912.
Could you tell whether this is a West Australian piece or not?
Well, the only way I would say that this is a West Australian piece is if it had a manufacturer's mark from Western Australia, but it's definitely not typical Western Australia.
Can I show you the mark?
Sure.
Okay.
What does it... Hang on. Your picture's rotating while I'm looking at it. What's the word? Asiatic labour. That's the great Australian way of preserving our imperial heritage. I would say that at the time, our patriotism towards our own nation and also towards the Commonwealth is extremely strong. And I suppose if in and amongst all of that, you had these aberrant pieces of furniture being made by Chinese immigrants or...
Why do you say aberrant?
Aberrant. Because in people's minds, they would want to know that their piece of furniture was basically made for them by a true blue, rigid-edge Australian cabinet maker.
And those words, Asiatic labour, that I'd originally taken to be a stamp, it wasn't a stamp at all. It was a brand, like branding livestock kind of brand. Paul was familiar with that too. Poker work, he said.
It had to be indelible. Yeah, because otherwise you could peel off the label and get away with it. One of the things about that label is it seems to be typically Australian as well. I've never seen it on an English piece of furniture. I've never seen it on a continental piece of furniture.
They didn't have a White Australia policy.
I was going to allude to that, but I wasn't 100% certain when the White Australia policy was really in full swing.
I wasn't 100% certain either. In fact, when I made that comment, I was really pretty much free associating. I mean, was it a piece of legislation? Was it a, if you'll forgive the expression, white paper? And what, if anything, did it have to do with my dressing table?
There never was something actually legally called the White Australia Act or the White Australia Policy.
That's historian Eddie Marcus. When I got back from Matilda's Antiques, a renewed frenzy of Googling had led me to Eddie and to his blog, Dodgy Perth, Sordid Tales of Western Australia.
This came to my attention initially because, you can tell from my accent, I'm of British origin, good European labour here, and I was doing a project for the City of Belmont Museum. And at one point, one of the volunteers took me to one side and said, "Have you looked under the table?" I said, "No, why would I look under a table? Is there something under there?" And he said, "No, literally, under the table. See what's written there." So I got on my back and looked, and there were these words, "European labour only." The stamps originate with what was called the Factories Act in Western Australia. So in 1902, it was deemed that it was necessary for every single piece of furniture to be stamped European labour only or Asiatic labour. The thinking was that you, as a racist buyer, would want to buy white-only furniture. It's probably not the case that you felt it was contaminated, but what you were doing, you were letting down your race.
So how did this fit into the broader picture of the White Australia policy? Can you explain that to me?
I certainly can. The Act is actually the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901 and the first piece of legislation to be passed by the new Commonwealth government. And for many people, this is the reason they voted for federation. Any right-thinking white man needs federation to keep out the foreign races. A vote for federation is a vote for a white Australia.
I assume those words were a paraphrase. They weren't. It was a direct quote from the main editorial of the Sydney Morning Herald on the eve of the vote for federation. So now I had the basic facts. And when I looked up the Factories Act for myself, there it was, in black and white. Every cabinet maker and dealer in furniture who sells or offers
for sale goods manufactured wholly or partly by Asiatic labour shall stamp such goods in the prescribed manner with the words Asiatic labour.
This law remained in force until 1963. Now, other states in Australia impose similar restrictions, but here in Western Australia, the reaction was extreme. Over in Victoria,
the furniture trade is practically in the hands of the chinks,
where, as the editor of one seamy Perth tabloid fumed in 1905,
several consignments have already reached Fremantle, where you can still buy chow-built chairs, tables and sideboards undisfigured by the objectionable words Asiatic labour.
The warning stamp, so-called, it was meant to deter European buyers, but did it accomplish the purpose? And was there any evidence that Asiatic furniture was inferior?
Absolutely none whatsoever. Absolutely none.
Antique dealer Paul Bowler.
They were as good as anybody. It definitely teach the Australians a thing or two at the time.
And, okay, I admit it. I couldn't resist an Antiques Roadshow moment.
I'm just curious, the piece that I showed you, just a quick appraisal of its value.
A piece like that would probably run today between $650 and $750 on a retail market. What did you pay for it?
$150.
Oh, bargain. A bargain.
Back home from my study window, I could hear the sounds of Fremantle Port, the same port where that quote-unquote Chow-built furniture had been arriving from Melbourne more than 100 years earlier. As fate would have it, China had been in the news that morning, too.
China's surprise well, decision to...
Isn't it usually these days? Once Australia rode on the sheep's back. Today, it seems to ride on the swishing tail of the Chinese dragon.
Largest trading partner.
In fact, Asiatic labor now makes the entire global economy go round. Back when my dressing table was being put together, Chinese labor was also, but in a very different kind of way, central to the local economy. It was both encouraged and feared.
We have to go back a little to understand why.
Chinese migration had been spurred by the gold rushes of the 19th century. In fact, Chinese constituted the largest ethnic group in Australia after the British.
As gold starts to decline, all the Chinese who had moved into the gold fields started moving into the cities.
Many took up service industries, laundry and catering and market gardening. But on the whole, these were menial, you know, low-paying jobs that English-speaking colonists were happy to pass on. But cabinet making? That was another story, and it made local trade unions nervous.
So suddenly, these white labourers were feeling the pinch.
In a nutshell, the Chinese product was cheaper and better. And that was a problem.
And that caused the unions to go for the easy option to try and restrict the sales by encouraging people to buy white only.
It's embarrassing today, and it's not hard to see why we tiptoe around it. Or worse, shut the whole shameful episode away and... history's back cupboard. In school in Western Australia, my children learned all about the African slave trade and about the civil rights movement, about apartheid, even about the stolen generations. And I'm glad. But about the white Australia policy? Not a word. Mind you, that's just us. There are plenty of Australians who are better informed. And I was lucky enough to speak to one of them at length.
Our grandfather, Ewan Hoipoi, he left his village just out of Zhongshan in around 1900.
Neville Hoipoi is 63. He's an electrical engineer. And his grandfather, Ewan, probably made my dressing table. Just stay with me on this one. So just before I spoke to Eddie Marcus, the historian, this was when I was still in Googling Overdrive, I turned up an oral history interview with a woman named Edie Hoipoi.
Could you give me your full name and date of birth?
Yes.
Now, I only listened to the tape because the name was obviously Chinese and she'd been born in Western Australia in 1927. So I figured maybe she'd have some memories of what it was like to grow up in the shadow of the White Australia years.
And they'd say such things as ching chong chong.
Well, on the tape, she talked mostly about her work with the Chang Hua Association. That's a group that supports and advocates for Perth's Chinese community. So I called them, and I learned that Edie's family by marriage, the Hoipois, had been Perth's most prominent Chinese cabinet makers. Okay, so Edie herself had passed away in 2011. But I was told there were contact details for a nephew, Neville. Maybe he would know more.
Granddad came over here. He went to Melbourne as an apprentice to his cousin in the furniture factory business. And he sent him over to Perth to establish their business over here. And he'd started up this furniture factory and was doing very well at it.
Hoi Poi's family business was located on James Street in the inner city Perth neighbourhood, known as Northbridge today.
He did very well. So he had a large house up on the avenue in Netherlands, and he was one of the first in Australia and WA to have a car.
Good fortune seemed to smile on him again when he met his future wife.
Well, he was actually doing a furniture delivery to her and met her, and she was over here from Victoria.
Mary Selina Brewer was just a teenager, 18 or 19. Ewan Hoi Poi was a prosperous businessman in his 30s. He was also movie star handsome.
Well, because she married a Chinese man, she was ostracised completely by the family. So from about 18 or 19 years old until she was probably 75, she never saw any of her family.
In the eyes of the law, Neville's grandmother became Chinese and she forfeited her British nationality. During World War II, she was ineligible for rations, and the family have bitter memories of that.
Well, during the war, they were given coupons. My Nana didn't get any, even though she was from Victoria, because she was married to a Chinese person.
During the First World War, patriotic fervour for the Empire stirred up even greater fear and distrust of the other. The Great Depression hobbled the business further, as it did to so many others. And a couple of mysterious factory fires pretty much finished it off. Despite all Neville knew about the family business, when I showed him a picture of the back of my dressing table, he looked shocked.
You ever see a thing like that? Can you read that? Here, take it. Can you read it for me?
Asiatic labour. No, I've never seen that before. So what was this offer for? Some furniture?
Piece of furniture I bought off Gumtree.
Really?
That's why I'm doing this story.
Really? That is the first concrete evidence I've seen that there was actually a policy that had to be stamped made with Asiatic labour.
The cumulative effect of all that, the formal policies, the informal prejudice, the words Asiatic labour, and what those words stood for, that's left an indelible mark.
I'd say the impact would have been, it's just whole life-changing. Well, I guess if it wasn't there, all of the three brothers would have gone into the factory and worked in the factory. For sure, my father would have become a carpenter and taken over the business. The area that he owned, that'd be worth an enormous amount of money, of course, and so I don't know really how that just all disappeared.
How does that make you feel now?
Well, I guess I'm kind of very Australian with just like let bygones be bygones. Because, you can change the future, you can't change the past. So we just move on. I guess they wanted them on one hand because they were skilled labour, but then when they start to get taking over our jobs, we think, well, hang on, we don't want this around. I mean, either you do or you don't. You can't have it whilst it suits you and then throw it out when it doesn't, which is what the case is.
I should show you a picture of the actual furniture that I bought.
Yeah. Okay. So it's actually the spitting image of a piece that my mother had. But on hers, the mirror tilted a little bit.
This mirror tilts?
Oh, does it? Wow, that's...
You're just giving me goosebumps.
But I never really looked at the back of that piece or anything of it. So.
Do you know where it is today?
At your place, I gather, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was Pine and Prejudice. The producer was Susan Mousehart and the sound engineer was David LeMay.